You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Felipe is a Berkman Fellow this year. He's also a PhD candidate at the London School of Economics. And he is the founder and director of, correct me if I mispronounce this, Fundación Ciudadano Inteligente.
Ciudadano Inteligente.
Yes, that. Which is a Latin American NGO that's based in Chile that uses information technology to promote transparency and active citizen participation. So welcome, Felipe.
Thank you. Okay. I'd like to stand up. Thank you very much for being here. Thanks a lot, Amar, for the introduction. I hope we are gathered today not only because, you know, we have great and free food, but hopefully because we're also, all of us, and from what I can hear from your quick introductions, you may be interested in, you know, all together in this big issue, this big word over here on the screen, the word of transparency, right? And when we talk about transparency, we may be also talking about several other things at the same time, right? So if we disaggregate the word of transparency, we may be also talking about freedom of information, open data, accountability, participation. And for all of us of the Berkman community, we are also very interested in how all of this might be changed in a way by the effects of the internet, of the web. How is the web changing transparency? How is it changing open data, accountability, and so on? So that's kind of what I want to say today. And just to very briefly highlight like the root of the presentation, there are mainly two ideas I would like to share today, and hopefully if I have enough time, share a third one. The first idea is that transparency is kind of a cliche. It's one of those words that is very sticky, that has been spread in terms of policy all over the world. And freedom of information laws have been one of the most prominent vehicles to spread transparency policies. And that because of the web, because of the internet, freedom of information laws are getting increasingly obsolete. So that is the first idea I would like to share. Second idea is that open data policy is necessary. It's a necessary way to keep this freedom of information promise that was originally secured by freedom of information law. Given that it's getting increasingly obsolete, open data appears to be the right way to ensure it over time, to secure it, while at the same time achieving other potential outcomes. And there's lots of rhetoric about this as well. There's a lot of potential impacts that open data might have. But one of them, and the one I want to highlight in this presentation, is the potential outcome impact in accountability. Moving from a closed kind of accountability towards a more open sort of accountability that I will later explain. So, again, let me start with, you know, this T-shirt over here, which is perhaps it's a very fuzzy idea, but just to point out that transparency is one of those words that is, again, very, very sticky. Many different sectors, organizations, people praise about transparency. A former professor at the LSE, now teaching at Oxford, Christopher Hood, pointed out that transparency was kind of a pervasive, or the most pervasive cliche of modern governance. And actually, he may be quite right, because transparency, again, is one of those words very much used. Governments praise transparency as a way to achieve accountability, participation. Businesses point out transparency as a good habitat for investment. You know, investment shied away from uncertainty. Increasing startup companies and tech-based companies are using information transparency for different services, businesses, etc. So again, it's one of those kind of pop concepts that everyone likes. And if you visualize it as a kind of a solar system, transparency could be benefiting all these different planets, right? Even if you get too close to this kind of transparency sun, you may even burn. And so there's lots of questions about transparency and privacy, transparency and national security. But again, so there's lots of different systems, planets that may be benefiting from the implementation of transparency policy.
So we all like transparency, and that's one of the reasons why it is getting, or it has been increasingly diffused all over the world. And this is a map of the world in terms of freedom of information laws. So you see, most part of the world has today some sort of transparency policy in place. And that actually is not necessarily correlated with impact measurements. We don't know actually much about what are the outcomes or the potential impacts of implementing transparency policies, but that's actually not stopping diffusion in any way. Actually, some people make a parallel between transparency policy diffusion and the agenda of new public management, right? So during the 80s, this idea that we can incorporate private sector practices into public sector, and that would be a very positive thing, without any kind of, you know, empirical test that that was the right thing to do, it happened, you know? New public management agenda moved forward in kind of the same way as the transparency agenda did, not very challenged policy. Now, when I mention transparency policy diffusion, what am I actually pointing out here? And this has been one of my main interests of research. I'm actually talking about freedom of information regulation. I understand that transparency policy is kind of an architecture where different pieces take place and are connected. So when you look at transparency policies, you should also take into account copyright, you should take into account secrecy laws, data management regulations. But probably one of the cornerstones of transparency policies has been actually this: freedom of information regulation, freedom of information law, FOIA, you name it. And the story of FOIA as the cornerstone of transparency policy is pretty long. It's not something recent. Actually, it was firstly articulated in 1667 by a Finnish priest, which happened to also be a deputy of the Sweden Congress, Anders Chydenius. He's said to be the father of freedom of information laws. And for some curious and weird reason, he ended up in a bill some years later. Today, this is I think it's a Finnish bill. I'm not sure, but it strikes me that the father of transparency is now in a bill. Anyway, so the transparency story of freedom of information laws again is a pretty long one. So after Sweden in 1959, Finland implemented its first FOIA. Then the U.S. in 1966, and many countries began to diffuse and began to implement freedom of information laws, mainly over the last 15 years. And freedom of information laws are basically about the regulation of two things. There's the principle of reactive transparency and proactive transparency, right? So freedom of information laws allow you to request information to the government, and the government must react to that information request and provide you that information. And also, freedom of information laws require governments to proactively disclose certain types of information, right?
What would have been precipitated that particular law at that time?
I think, well, there's many different reasons why countries might have implemented freedom of information laws. I don't know which one was the original reason from the Swedish experience. Actually, Chydenius mentioned or has pointed out that he created this first law based on a former institution called the Bureau of Censorship of the Qing Dynasty. The reason why modern governments have been implementing freedom of information laws vary very much. So you have first wave adopters, for example. So you might point out that there's no particular kind of pressure to implement that because they're early adopters. You might speak about a democratic evolution, perhaps, in a way. Other countries might do it for some kind of economic reasons. So you have, for example, Croatia, which implemented freedom of information law in the context of their application or joining the EU community. So it was a nice thing to have. Other countries like Zimbabwe, or you can say Russia as well, have also freedom of information laws in place. Someone might argue that's because you want to show some kind of democratic credentials. China has a freedom of information law in place, and it has it for actually very different reasons. It's about more of a control from the central part of the party. So you can, you know, get information as a principal agent from the very local cantons to the center. So reasons to implement it are pretty wide and varied in each country. So free information laws are about these two arms again, reactive transparency and proactive transparency. A bit more than a year ago, I did this cross-national study looking at 67 countries, 67 free information laws. And I particularly compared about 32 FOIA variables. And using cluster analysis, I could examine that actually law designs, FOIA designs, were pretty similar, and they actually clustered into five main groups, right? So FOIA laws are pretty much alike all over the world. You know, groups are different, but they do share certain features. And one of the main features freedom of information laws in the world share is that they heavily rely on reactive transparency rather than proactive transparency, right? So just to point out here that transparency, again, is a big issue. Everyone claims about it. There's lots of potential impacts that are expected, but our main policy instrument that we have had over the last years is freedom of information laws. It's just heavily relying on reactive transparency, which is information that flows from a requester to the government and back, right? And why does this happen? It happens because the mindset behind FOIA is not about access to data, actually, right? In the years it was created, the mindset is more about access to documentation, which is information that has been in some way created, manipulated by civil servants. It's about reports, etc. So that information flows, according to FOIA, mostly on requests coming from citizens and response coming from the government. It's not about, again, access to data. And it is that one of the main reasons why I argue that basically FOIAs, in terms of one of the main instruments to norm transparency policies, is actually being increasingly obsolete. So in our year, 2012, most of the information that the government has is not actually flowing in this type, right? There are, of course, reports. There are even digital, you know, you have PDFs. But also lots of the information that the government holds is available in data sets, right? In columns of information about schools, about hospitals, about machinery that, you know, hospitals have, about housing, transport, etc. And that information that could be understood as neutral facts, right? So it's just columns of information, are not necessarily, you know, not every data set is then turned into a report of some kind. And in that way, in most of freedom of information laws, you cannot access that kind of information. So FOIA is getting increasingly obsolete. And it's obsolete because you can't access all government information. As I was just pointing out, neutral facts and data sets in most freedom of information laws you can't access. You might find cases where countries through court might have interpreted in a very wide way you can sometimes access data, but in most cases you actually can't. Second reason why FOIA is also obsolete in this way, it's because FOIA is a two-way communication system. There's no sharing of information, right? So you ask an information request, you get your response, but that information is not flowing. It doesn't, I mean, Mika, you just arrived, it's kind of FOIA's understand is working in the context of scarcity, right? It's not a context of information abundance. And that's another big reason why FOIA is getting increasingly obsolete. Also, in freedom of information laws, you have gatekeepers who in the end decide what you can know and what you can't. If you want to make an information request to the government, you have to submit your request. That request will then go to a FOIA liaise, very likely. If it's a sensitive question, he's very likely to ask his boss, who then asks his boss to, you know, ask if that information should be released or not. So at the end, you have to go through these gatekeepers to to access information. And if you don't get, you don't like the information you got, you can always appeal, but you can go to courts. That's not very, you know, a nice thing to happen, because as we can see from a very recent report from the New York Times, there are certain requests that go through the whole loop of going to courts and back, and they can take 5, 10, 15 to 20 years. Okay? So these are all reasons why, at our year 2012, and because of the web, FOIA is getting increasingly obsolete. And that has been one of my main concerns here. Again, the cornerstone of transparency policies over the last 15 years, freedom of information laws, is basically not understanding the rules of the web, the rules of the internet. And that's not good news. Now, the good news is that the story of transparency policies doesn't end here. Since May of 2009, we saw this up here. We saw data.gov, which is a website that was led by Berkman Fellow, Vivek Kundra. The U.S. was the first one to implement this open data policy, which is about releasing public data in machine-readable formats, as I will mention in a few slides later. And after the U.S. also came lots of other countries. You know, May 2009, the U.S., September 2009, the U.K., and then lots of other countries have been starting to implement these new breed of transparency policies under the form of open data initiatives. There's Kenya, and even the World Bank, as an international organization, has now been releasing much of their research as open data. Okay? Again, data that is available online, which is accessible in machine-readable format, so we can use. The open data community has also pointed out some characteristics that open data initiatives or policies might should have. I will not stress each one of these individually right now, but just to point out quickly, it is said that hopefully in the ideal world, this data should be available raw, online, complete, primary, timely. It should be accessible in machine-readable formats, license-free, so we can reuse this information, non-discriminatory, and finally, non-proprietary. Interestingly, in a very similar way as freedom of information laws, like the curve that we saw of diffusion, open government data policies are also diffusing very, very quickly. And of course, because of the web, it's diffusing much, much quicker than freedom of information laws did. So just between 2009 2012, we have now 28 countries that have implemented some sort of open government data policy. Now, why is this good news? Why does this actually matter that we now begin to see more of these open data initiatives to come up? Again, using the analogy of the planets and transparency giving light to several other planets, well, kind of the same thing happens with open government data policies. You know, there are different planets that may benefit from the implementation of open data policy. The first one is the rights planet. And this is one of the main arguments. It's that open data may have the ability to keep our freedom of information right up to date, right? So through open data policies, we can now access much of the information that government holds. Those data sets of neutral facts, you now might be able to access them. So again, the promise of freedom of information is actually up to date. Second, it also gets rid of this two-way communication to settle up a multi-way communication as the web works, right? So you just publish information online, you can download it, share it, do whatever you want. And again, therefore, open data understands the logic of information abundance. There are no more, or at least there's less, gatekeepers, right? So if you want to ask or request or access, information from the government, you don't have to ask for it. You basically just go online, you search it, you download it, so you get rid of gatekeepers. Now, one could still say, you know, there's still someone who actually uploads that file, so there's still some gatekeepers, but at least there's less, and there's less control in a way. Because even if a gatekeeper might, release one piece of data set that, I don't know, might look like inoffensive, like very neutral, still, if you cross-reference that data set perhaps with another one, you can come up with a story and perhaps, I don't know, identify some corruption or whatever. So there's less power to control. A gatekeeper cannot foresee the amounts of cross-reference you could do with that data that is available. Very briefly, also point out to other potential benefits of some of these other planets. It is also pointed out that there's a potential benefit for economic growth and public service delivery. One of the most typical cases of potential growth is the impact that the release of open data may have in low-end markets. So we're all very familiar to this. Companies, startups, they are creating apps that you can easily download for $1, $2, and by selling thousands and thousands of those applications, you can basically create a revenue. Also, using public data, startups or NGOs are using it to create some sort of public service delivery as well. Probably the case that you and I are most familiar to is examples of web applications that actually help you to use public transport, for example, maps. And finally, just to point out, the planet where I mostly live in, actually most of my year, it's the accountability planet. I run an NGO in Latin America called Ciudad Inteligente, and we basically use technology and information as a mechanism to promote transparency and accountability. And in this case, I would like to argue that access to open data has a positive impact on accountability in a way that it's changing the rules of accountability, moving from a traditional kind of more closed-like accountability relationship towards a more open and participative sort of accountability relationship. So we move from an accountability that has been traditionally exercised very formally by procedures, by existing institutions, to a more informal-like of accountability, that it's crowdsourced, that people can participate online and oversight what government does. Move from a world of scarcity of watchdogs, where basically the press was the main watchdog to account, to oversight what the government was doing, towards more of an abundance of web watchdogs, among which my NGO is part of it. There's a now growing community of watchdogs that are using the web, they are using internet tools, and they are using public data to oversight what government is doing. And also move from a traditional kind of accountability where citizens basically accounted their representatives every 4 years in elections to a more of a continuous benchmark of citizens taking government to account during the period between one election and the other. So it's no longer just accountability. It's more about open sort of accountability right now because of the effect of the web and access to public information, access to public data. Global Voices did, a couple of years ago, started this project called Technology for Transparency with the aim to map some of the existing projects around the world that are breeding in terms of using technology and access to data to promote transparency and accountability. And among those projects, just point out some of the ones you may be most familiar to. A local example of this has been the Sunlight Foundation, who is actually one of the main leaders in this field. In the UK, My Society is also a great example of organizations that are creating new tools and are using public data to account. Ushahidi is probably one of the most deployed tools, born, as you know, in Africa, to kind of do the same thing. And we are trying to do the same thing as well as Ciudad Inteligente in South America and Latin America more regionally. Let me point out to what exactly we do and bring an example that probably makes sense in terms of what I have been, you know, explaining about open data and how is that changing the accountability relationship. As Ciudad Inteligente, we have about 12 to 15 different apps and websites today. But one that could, again, serve as a good example to basically reinforce the idea I was mentioning is the Inspector of Interest, one of our recent web apps. What the Inspector of Interest does is aim to account potential conflicts of interest in the Chilean Congress, okay? And how can we do that? Well, we use the web, we organize, we create a web application, so on, but we heavily rely on open data to exercise that online accountability. We basically gathered, we built a data set with all the information members of Congress released proactively about their assets and company participation. According to freedom of information law, they are required to actually publish this information. We looked at that data set that we organized, and we realized that much of that information was not really complete. It didn't seem much reliable. So we began to build an alternative data set to basically contrast this information that was released by members of Congress. So we used access to open data coming from the Tax and Revenue Service, from the Public Register, to basically map alternatively which were the assets that members of Congress had. Again, perhaps each one of those alternative data sets might not be, again, inoffensive in themselves, but when you cross it with other data sources, you can actually tell which are the company participation in assets that members of Congress had. So we basically compared the two, again, information coming from open data sources with the information that members of Congress had released proactively, and you could tell that actually nearly half of the Chilean members of Congress were not publishing all their assets. And they were not fulfilling the law that required them not only to disclose, but actually avoid to vote in an issue where they could have a potential conflict of interest. So this is just one particular profile. This senator, for example, has 64% of his assets not declared. You could tell which are the business sectors where those assets are from, if it's either, I don't know, fishery, forest, banking, whatever. The names of the companies, if it's declared or it's not declared, and so on. And also, again, bringing back the idea of a crowdsource, citizens can also report new information, new hints about information we should look after to exercise this accountability as a bigger community. Okay? So this is just an example of how the web and how access to open data might change the way we understand traditional accountability towards a more open kind of accountability. It's an example where we use open and public data that is available online. It's an example where that data is machine readable, where particular data sets might be, again, inoffensive, but if when you cross-reference with other data sets, you can come up with this important story, which is a practical example of accountability. The crowd also helps. They provide new hints of information that we can then look after. And again, it's an ongoing accountability exercise. So citizens use this tool during the process of legislation, right? So it's not just by voting, but it's actually between the whole period between one election and the other that accountability can happen. Let me point out, I think I have a bit more time, to the third idea about some practical examples, more examples, some evidence about what is going on with open data initiatives. Again, using the same example of the solar system, and because open data is one of those things that potentially may benefit lots of different planets, it also gathers a big group of supporters. So we have come up with some kind of a weird coalition that gathers governments, businesses, geeks, NGOs, media, international organizations that are pushing all together for open data policies to be implemented. Governments have been reacting to this, and we have been increasingly seeing new examples of open data initiatives happening. This is just a picture of the Open Government Partnership Initiative, which is an initiative at an international level so that member countries can commit to implementing transparency policies, and open data being one of them. In just 3 years, we now have 118 open data catalogs available from different countries with that big number of data sets. But I would just like to highlight that even though there's lots of talking, there's lots of cocktails, pictures about promoting this agenda, it's still these are just the very, very first step, and there's lots to be done. Most of the open data initiatives that exist today, catalogs, portals, are not actually driven at a national level. So you can't talk about a kind of a top-down policy or commitment at a state level, at a national level, again, to promote open data policies. Most of the experiments or experiences, again, come from the local level, right? So we have seen much more of cities releasing data, organizing hackathon contests, instead of a top-down driven open data policy. Also, what is very interesting to see is that most of the information that is actually today available online, and data.gov from the US is actually a big sample of this, most of the information today available in data catalogs is not very useful information. So, for example, this big blue bar over here is images. Most of the data that governments are publishing today are about images, boundaries. There's something good here, transport. There's, again, lots of examples of how this has been used. But again, inland waters, oceans, structures, climate, not much about education, health. And if you see, the worst one is, of course, banking and finance. That could be expected. But anyway. This is the number of data sets available.
Number of data sets?
This is done by the Rensselaer Polytech Institute. So they basically scrapped all the data from all these catalogs that they had listed, so you can tell actually how much information has been published online and which issues.
By item, number of items, or amount of the size of the files?
No, items. Okay. Items. And that's why images is so big, right? So just final thoughts before I would like to open the floor and have a conversation. So what I've tried to present here is a very quick, I know transparency, again, is one of those big issues that is very cross-topic, and sometimes it's very, very fuzzy to actually grab it and present it. But I've been trying aiming to point out that the implementation of open data policies matters, and one of the issues for which it matters the most, and the one that I have been particularly interested in, is the impact on accountability, trying to shift from a former closed kind of accountability towards a more open and participatory sort of accountability. I've also tried to point out that this may have, and I underline the word main potential, it hasn't been tested, but at least there's lots of claims outside that open data policies may have a potential impact, positive impact, in not only governance, but also businesses and the delivery of public services. But if I could just stress one particular idea, if I can just leave you guys with a single idea to take home, is this, and it's that in a context of transparency being this big word, where there's lots of claims surrounding it, for years our main instrument from the policy side, from the regulation side, has been freedom of information laws. And as they stand today, they are basically getting obsolete and not allowing us to access much of the information that actually governments are holding. And that's why to promote the use of open data policies is important in a way that we can ensure we can secure our access or to information, secure our right to information. There's also, again, lots of enthusiasm about promoting this kind of policy, this kind of agenda. There's lots of events, cocktails, pictures, commitments to implement open data policies. But unfortunately, what we have seen today is not much information that can be actually used. So the call would be for governments to strongly commit to this. It is important to keep our freedom of information right up to date. And again, so it's not only to exercise accountability in a more open, participatory way, but as I was pointing out, it is our one of the key ways to ensure that freedom of information rights, which have a long story, can still keep up to date. So yeah, that's kind of what I wanted to present. Thank you.
So, I have a question.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with the My Data initiative in the UK? And is it relevant to what you've been talking about?
My Data, no?
No, it's MIDATA. And it's a new effort in the UK to make personal data available in an easily extractable way. It's confined to personal data at this point, but the idea behind it is that you as a citizen should have much more capability for knowing what to do with your data than we do, but they're also trying to expand that to modeling what corporations can also do, and they're working with a number of sectors in the commercial sector to get them to do the same thing. That's one thing you should know about. The other is, I wonder if there's with Google started something called the Data Liberation Front, where they've come up with some systems by which it's very easy for individuals to extract their data from Google services like Casa and Google Plus and so forth. And I'm wondering if some of their technology might be useful to government or a model for government as well.
Mm-hmm. Should we... Amar collects some of them. Yeah. You raise your hand.
The courtesy. I was going to channel your stuff anyways.
So I'd like to challenge both your first argument about FOIA and a second argument about open data. So FOIA, you say that now we have neutral facts. I'm not sure if there is such a thing called neutral facts. Any data set, it's designed by someone, it's structured by someone, but it is by no means neutral. So when you rely on data sets, you just insert more. The discretion is different, but it's still there. So that's the neutral facts part. No gatekeepers. I'm not sure why. Actually, when you are proactive and not reactive, you decide what kind of information is being released. And you say, well, but they still may release something that might be helpful. It's true, but they might not. And it's completely up to them what they release and what they do not release, especially with cases like data.gov, where they do not have any kind of specific guideline what information should be there. So instead of relying on actually the demand for information, which is FOIA, you give much more priority to supply of information, and then there might be a huge mismatch between demand and supply because FOIA allows us to somehow translate the demand into supply. Maybe imperfectly, but this is the idea. And here you say, well, we'll take the supply and we'll do something with it, but you have no control over the supply or the policy of what is being supplied. So that's the gatekeepers. Sharing. I'm not sure why FOIA prevents effective sharing. In the UK, for instance, there is this new FOIA portal, which makes, by My Society, it makes all FOIA requests public, and the responses are also public. And then it's very easy to share this information, to work with it, and also it's a method to pressure governments, because the request is public, so it might be more difficult not to respond at all or to say something which is... not very meaningful. So that's the FOIA part. And then the second part of your optimism about open data, I'm afraid that you somehow do not discuss the contents. So you say, well, economic growth, but we cannot really know unless we know exactly what are these policies contain. And if currently, as you said, it's all about images or mostly about images, what kind of an incentive do we have now so that these types of information would be different? And then also, we, of course, depend on civil society. So Chile is lucky to have your organization, which does all these amazing things, but in other countries, we don't have similar organizations. And then what we do? So this information just lies somewhere, and government creates this legitimacy window dressing that, here we go, we release so much information, but actually this information is not being useful and is not being used. So the dependence on NGOs is a bit problematic as a policy matter. And then accountability, I'm not sure you have, you presented a definition of accountability. So what does it mean that actually by having open data, we have more accountable, a more accountable government? And then how can citizens hold governments accountable based on this information? So something seems to be missing. I'll just.
Very big list, yeah. I think it would actually be really useful to have a conversation when there's a basic question on the table that says, you know, we're all cheering open data, but weather data and where there are all sorts of traffic lights is not what we care about. What we care about is, does the Department of Homeland Security pay General Dynamics to look at our tweets and figure out whether we want to destroy America or not? That comes out of Epic's FOIA request and the document of the contract that came out in January. Do we think the FBI does or doesn't violate people's privacy in banks? That comes out of the EFF's FOIA request in December. I don't think it's something you can just move. That's the central question on this table.
Mm-hmm.
And just a quick follow-up. I mean, there's a United States-based FOIA portal called MuckRock, which is nowhere near as big as the UK portal, but the same sort of effort to communitize, you know, FOIA requests and, you know, broadcast the data.
One last one, then. You mentioned earlier about the idea of two-way sharing between requester and presumably some state actor. That struck me as a major departure from the FOIA model that, and not one that I see as being inherently necessary. And it's also something that has some currency because at least in one chamber of Congress or another, there's recently a discussion about how to facilitate cybersecurity data sharing between DHS and the private sector, which looked like it would become an extension of the national security state. What would you see as being appropriate data for private parties to share with the government? What rights should they then gain or lose by having done so? And what responsibility does the government have to disclose that information and to whom? And could this not easily lead to a form of data laundering where data that's illegitimately obtained is sort of passed through this process, a data sharing process to give it the veneer of legitimacy when it's in fact not?
I'm not sure if I understood correctly
that the last question. Perhaps we can come up back to it if I can answer in a way or comment on some of the other questions that are also above the table. Jennifer, there's yes, I mean, what you point out is very true. The several things you mentioned. What I mean with the first question was about the you mentioned gatekeepers, and before that you mentioned neutral facts, right? Okay, right. So there's not such thing as neutral facts, you can say. What I was trying to point out is that freedom of information laws are basically regulating the disclosure or the ability to access existing documents, and documents different from data sets in a way that they are creations or manipulations of some sort from civil servants that have created a document as we know it, as a report. And what I mentioned by neutral facts is basically lists of data, right? So you know the number, you know the column of the number of policemen that are on the streets, you know, right? So you create still the columns and the files, and that's not neutral, but that's basically what I meant. And today, on freedom of information laws, basically you cannot access neutral facts because governments are not compelled to provide or to respond to information that doesn't exist in terms of being created or manipulated. So basically, again, the framework is to access existing documents and reports, but you can't access information that has to be manipulated in a way, right? So the information file, the data might exist, but if it's not in a report, basically you can't access that information through a FOIA request in most countries. So that's basically what I want to say there. About gatekeepers, yes, it's that's why I mentioned that there will still be gatekeepers. I do think that, we can discuss about how less gatekeepers there are or not, but I just want to point out that the fact that there is some sort of release of power on gatekeepers because of proactively releasing data. And that assumption is based, again, on the idea that they might control whether to release one data set or not, but they can't foresee what might be the information that can be crossed from different data sets, and sometimes not even from a single country. You can, you know, use information from the World Bank, for example, related to your own country that you cross-reference with another data sets, and you can come up again with some sort of a corruption story or whatever. So, yes, there still are gatekeepers, absolutely. What I just want to point out is that by implementing open data, there's less, less control, at least.
And demand change, because you, by open data, you don't answer to actual demand for information. So what you do is that when you can really cross-reference and find a lot of different data sets and you come up with something, not necessarily because of a demand. It's not like you hire examples, for instance. No, you need to know some very specific information as a journalist.
Right.
And you go and file a FOIA request to understand how is the money was spent or what the decision was taken or whatever it is. But by relying on data sets, it's very difficult to assume that you get this information just, you know, by accident, because these five data sets happen to be released in different times or different countries.
Right, right.
So it's this shift from demand for information, which is not perfect, of course, and courts sometimes, of course, defer to governments, and information is not being driven, but at least it's demand driven. And with open data policy, it's much more supply driven, and then we might lose some very important information that...
But anyway, even with existing freedom of information law as it in place, it's still pretty much supply-driven. So you can still request information, and they have the total control if they're going to release it or not. So, of course, there is another question that is permanent and has... It's a bigger question, as Yochai was mentioning. It's a question about, finally, privacy as well. I mean, what is public, what is private, what are governments keen to release or not? I don't know, and it hasn't been tested. You know, we both have been working on this in this field for some time. If open data, which is actually pretty new and just at least our attention, is creating new demand, we don't know exactly if that is the case. So it might be that are the same questions. People are not addressing new information requests, or just simply going, might, if there's enough information, might go online and search for that information. We don't know if there's a change in that way in supply and demand. That's something that is yet to be seen, I think.
I think maybe part of what's happening, right, is the framing of open data as the new FOIA is kind of at the core of some of the pushback that you're getting. So in other words, you know, you could easily imagine a situation where the types of open data sets that get released, there are mechanisms by which they respond to demand. So you could say,
Right.
People are requesting the data about what's going on and where. Let's open the full data set of government expenditure. And that would be an example of responding to an aggregate demand on a particular data. But Yochai's point is that, you know, at the end of the day, you know, the state's not going to push into the open data sets the stuff that really matters. So then, you know, you would, I don't know, to be provocative, you might want to reframe it and be like, well, WikiLeaks would be the new FOIA, not open data, right? Open data is another mechanism by which the public can access all kinds of important information, but it's not a replacement. So maybe the issue is with the framework, not with the...
Absolutely. Okay.
I suspect Bradley Manning would have issues with the efficacy of that particular mechanism.
Right, of course.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't, or it wasn't my intention to point out as kind of... open data policies being the new and replacing FOIA. I think, actually, as I see it, it's much more of a complement to FOIA than a replacement in a way that it is still necessary. I mean, FOIAs, what they do is that they basically define, or at least they recognize the rights citizens have to access information, and you can file information requests that are very specific and ask questions about information that, you know, at least at this point, perhaps if we move further into the semantic web, it might be easier to ask a bigger sets of data. But today, you can, through request, you can ask for very specific information. The point is that, again, it's something we need to advance much more. And that's why I pointed out the last pictures of not much actually useful data being out there. But to complement freedom of information laws, I think open data might be a right alternative to access much of this information that relies, again, on what I mentioned as neutral facts, that again are not neutral, but are data sets, and those are you can't access through freedom of information laws. And most countries, if you file a request about a data set, you won't basically get it because it's not information that has been created into a record, but it relies on neutral facts, data sets.
So I guess you're to some extent on the receiving end, because you set it up so comfortably to be on the receiving end of this pushback, and to some extent, at least on my end, I think it's because you're representing a fairly widely adopted stance about transparency, which is to say the political and emotional energy gets poured into open data and the excitement about open data, so that the players who are deemed to be good actors in fact are not good actors. If an administration puts millions of bits of data that are irrelevant on data.gov,
right,
while bringing more criminal prosecutions against whistleblowers than all the administrations prior to it, interposing state secrecy in lawsuits for in private actions to cover up materials, for that administration to be held up as the model of transparency by a mobilized global community that cares about transparency is a real problem. And then there are specific questions of what are the interesting interventions. So Jennifer raises the idea of FOIA or the phenomenon of FOIA being done transparently so as to change the political dynamics of postponing responses. Now, in the universe of what are exciting technological interventions into transparency, whether data.gov is or whether sharing FOIA is depends fundamentally on what you think the core is. If you think the core is forcing the government to reveal precisely the things that it will stand on its head and wiggle its ears not to have to do, then those are the interesting interventions. And open data is a really important, valuable complement that then you can cross-reference all sorts of things. If you think that at the end of the day, you can't hide behind, once you have the data out there, then you're right. The data needs to go out there. But I think the question of whether we need to think of this as FOIA is obsolete and data is the thing, or whether data is a good complement, but fundamentally, we need to find ways to strengthen FOIA and focus the political energy on that, I think it is really important. And I think that your presentation very much represents the zeitgeist around open data, and that deserves thinking.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So I just have to ask, who was praising the Obama administration for being the most open? I feel like I heard a bit of a straw man there. I didn't hear Philippe do that. He was quite critical of data.gov. I mean, I agree that the mistake is perhaps not to say that FOIA is obsolete, but FOIA can be updated. Most interesting project there is MuckRock in the United States, which is like, what do they know in the UK, which is making FOIA requests more social. Mm-hmm. But I'm sorry, Yochai, because I don't feel like there's anyone in the transparency movement that I know of is running around praising what the Obama administration is doing. When I mean, there are some older advocates who are not using data to open up government who gave them an award, and they were all criticized for it. People laughed at that.
So I'm responding to some extent, I guess, to the framing in this presentation that sets up data.gov as a model, and to the fact that it ends up being the model that gets diffused when you're looking.
Yeah, okay, so just a few reactions. I would later like to point out to this example, which is an example that we, or an application that we built, kind of part of the same family as What Do They Know and other applications that do this. I was pointing out to the idea that open data policies, such as freedom of information policy or regulations did, is highly diffusing. I'm not saying if it's good or bad. Actually, I was pointing out in the initial part of the conversation that this, again, is a very fuzzy topic. It comes from different grounds. It is praised by different people, even by very different motives. Data.gov is just the fact that it was the first thing to happen. And that's what I was just pointing out, after which followed several other ones. There is also an issue that I think is relevant. You have pointed out to the core issues, as you mentioned, on the table, issues that in the end, no matter if it's an open data policy or it's a freedom of information request, government might decide to release or not to release. You pointed out big examples from the FBI or, you know, any kind of other examples. I think that is very important, that it's absolutely true. But that doesn't mean also that there might be other smaller, non-provocative issues that by releasing it through open data, which are actually happening, are also telling us a story, right? Data sets, again, about transport, data sets like the ones I pointed out as an example of what we did. So it's very inoffensive data. It's not core CIA stuff, but it's good enough to actually take into account members of Congress were actually voting against potential conflicts of interest. So what I'm trying to say is that this is opening up an opportunity as a policy. I'm not saying if it's working or not. Again, it's very, very recent. But it brings up a new door of opportunities that can help us to move forward just from transparency, relying on the, you know, back and forth of information requests individually towards actually searching data that is available online. Much has to be done. What we have seen just recently is, you know, again, that's why I mentioned pre-ironically, like cocktails and pictures of praising open data policies, but at the same time, there's not many, much useful data out there. We are also using technology not purely about open data. This tool over here is actually trying to use what we already have in Chile, which is not open data policies, but freedom of information requests. So similar to the idea of What Do They Know, we build a website that basically gathers into a single window, to a single one-stop shop, the idea of you can request information to any kind of agency from the government. All the questions as well as all the answers are published into a single database that you can search. You are a user in this platform as well, so you can follow other people's requests. So we basically aim to create common knowledge, crowdsource knowledge, of all the different information requests that used to just flow individually into this big bag. So this is just an example of other ways of which you can also use technology as means to use what we already have, in this case, freedom of information laws in place. Juan Carlos.
I was just making a general consideration that If you look at the broader landscape of society, you have individuals, and we are told to forget about privacy, and our personal data are collected by governments and corporations. Then you have the government, and that's the topic of your presentation. Isn't it something missing? What about corporations? Are they the only one that are not subject to social scrutiny?
Right. Absolutely. It's in terms of just the data that was available, of course, issues related more to corporations were the less data sets available. Freedom of information law does not touch very much that sector. Corporations are not touched by freedom of information law. The only issues where you see some kind of FOIA innovation is in issues of the environment, where you see some freedom of information acts on environmental issues. The UK is an example, for example, that points out to that. But no, I mean, most of the data or the information from businesses are not accessible through FOIA, unless if there is some kind of connection with the public sector. So if there's, for example, a contracting information that is in the hands of a ministry, that could be potentially accessed through FOIA requests. There's a list, I didn't mention it, of course, but there's a list of reasons why information might not be disclosed. Those lists or exceptions to FOIA exceptions are pretty common and commonly shared among different countries. That's one of the things I could examine from this cross-national comparison. And issues like personal data protection, national security, again, international relations are some of these issues that might basically block the final release of public information.
I have a question, which is to follow up on Jennifer's comment about relying on NGOs to analyze this information. And so in your experience, how well is this project of sort of enabling the social web to sift and make meaning out of the raw data going? How important is it to have these intermediaries who know how to work with the data? Where do you see that field developing?
Mm-hmm. So these kind of data.gov platforms?
No, in general. I mean, what you're doing in Chile with you know, can an average citizen get a hold of the information and do things with it, or do they need you? And to what degree are your tools being used by average citizens as opposed to, you know, the condescending?
Right. I think it's, again, this is a very recent field come up with more heavy studied or empirical kind of findings about this. There's not much out there. From the personal experience of what we have done, yes, it's in many cases it's complicated information. Of course, it's data. It's not like pop information that you can find, you know, in a newspaper whatsoever. So at an average citizen level, they do rely partly on intermediaries. I would say that still the press is the most heavy one to finally interpret or use that kind of information to come up with a story that can be later watched on the news or read on the metro on a newspaper. We have been seeing an increase of users from our own applications that we are using this kind of information. And actually, one of those users is then the media itself, right, that is using these tools to be able to identify the data sets that in themselves might be very complicated.
The idea of reactive versus proactive, and I have the feeling that the reactive demands of information rest upon the participation of citizens to make demands. Whereas the proactive, I would fear, and I think those were your comments, that it might create passivity, and it really relies on what the government wants to give. So I guess my question would be on specifically on releasing data, instead of asking for open data and for sort of an overflow of undifferentiated data, could there be any kind of push for a more reactive participation
of citizens to demand specific data, for example, on business and banks, private sector and banks. I mean, everything that's happening right now, I feel like that would be, that would sort of supplement victories that FOIA's battles have won by actually pushing it further and demanding specific data breach.
Right.
And do you see it happening rather than sort of doing something with the data that is being given to us and that is maybe uninteresting? On the contrary, being more reactive, maybe more provocative in demanding specific types of data.
Right. So, I mean, I don't have an answer to it in from the sense of the problem of supply and demand that Jennifer was actually asking earlier. I do think that actually you need to push for both, and that's what we try to do from the NGO side of things. We try to push for more reactive transparency. We want more people to submit information requests and address questions that haven't been pointed out earlier. That's why we created the website I just showed, to basically easy up the idea of asking questions to the government to a single window. If you want to do it from the classic point of view, it could take you quite a while. You actually need to find out how to ask a question, to who address it, and so on. And when you get a response, again, it's a two-way communication. That's what I was mentioning. The tool we build is basically getting that information to share with some more people. We need to definitely push for more reactive transparency, but that is by no means is an alternative, but just a complement to also push for more proactive disclosure at the same time. So again, addressing the first comment, I see open data as a complement to freedom of information in a way that, you know, more people should, of course, get government to react and respond to requests, but at the same time, we should push governments to take this seriously and publish much more data than they're actually publishing right now.
This suggests a response to Sasha's comment that you around the framing, because there's an alternative framing here, which says here's the old FOIA, here's the new open data. What we need is a crossing of the reactive and the proactive, so that we can proactively demand through Freedom of Information Act. Access to open data sets that we otherwise can't demand, that those should be subject to demand as well. And so the frame, you can, I think, say what you've been saying within a frame that doesn't make exactly the wall that you're dividing, but in fact says that we need to take one sort and apply it to the other. So we should be able to demand open data, which I assume you agree with, that we should be able to do that. Yeah.
I think the other thing that sort of underlies this is that there are two different motivations. There's sort of the macro level political accountability, where you most specifically want the data that, you know, the authorities most specifically don't want to give you, you know, whether it's WikiLeaks or, you know, the database of contractors and, you know, what their mission is to watch our tweets. And then there's sort of the functional mechanical aspect of government. I mean, where you want the transactional data sets to make government as a machine, you know, operate data. I mean, you know, the example in the Boston area is the, you know, MBTA, you know, live position of where all the, you know, buses and subway trains are, which, you know, I suppose you could, you know, turn into some political accountability if you had some theory around it, but it's really about, you know, are the trains running on time and when's the next one going to eat both, and I don't think they're in, you know, opposition. There's just a different motivation going on.
So I think we've got time for one more question. Mark? Well, I think we've got time for one more question.
Okay.
Hey, just, Kelly, this is trying to work very much at the community level, and I think in a way we're sort of assuming that the intermediaries or intermediaries are going to be neutral bodies, and I know in most countries NGOs are not completely neutral. So, you know, I have a big question about sort of how it's going to play out in terms of how the media and how the NGOs are supporting communities and what types of data are being pulled out by different bodies. I'm certain that the media, perhaps in the U.S., is not going to be an unbiased party in this either. So Yeah, I have that question, and then I also have a question if anybody knows of any examples where citizens are being consulted about what type of information they might want to see on open data government portals. And I'm talking just from my own perspective of working with rural communities and, for example, Kenya Open Data. I mean, are communities being consulted, or is it just the World Bank basically tells the Kenyan government what they should put up there, or they put whatever they have up there, or does that kind of work?
Yeah, the example of the Kenyan Open Data platform is a pretty good one to point out to this idea about cliché. And it has nothing to do actually with demand. And that's one of the biggest challenges we have. The Kenyan Open Data platform was outsourced basically to Socrata to be implemented in Kenya. And now Kenyans basically have it and don't know actually what to do with it. And again, that might be, a good example of why of the wrong way this could take, as a rhetoric. And still remains the problem of demand. Related to your question at a more local level, I think it's also there might be a challenge here. It might be a problem also the problem might be if local governments or governments generally don't release information because they don't rely on what intermediaries might actually do with them. Actually, I would like to ask you back and point out to what kind of concerns might you have from a local level to what could happen with that kind of information. And at the end, we could basically, weight it in terms of those concerns being higher or more heavier than public interest. But I think I don't know what's going to be the alternative, basically, to that. So I...
may not have access to internet, that may not speak English, that may not, have those capacities, how easy then it would be for anybody to come in and really manipulate the data that's being sort of fed to communities that can't go on and verify it on their own. I suppose maybe you assume that, the broader social good is you're just going to start fighting and doing app and, I don't know if that's how it'll play out, kind of like comment streams on blog posts or something. I just think that'll be really interesting to see how that works. And we've had communities in Kenya that have looked at the open data that's up, and it says, this blah, blah, blah was completely spent, but they're doing social accountability work on the ground and saying, well, it was spent, but it's a crap project. The community the committee that implemented the project was completely corrupt. The local politician came in and put his name on it, though he didn't fund it. So there's this stuff coming up on the open portal that this was spent and it was a good project, but then the reality at community level is exactly the opposite. So I think those things need to merge and meet at some point.
So just going to close by saying that the main intention of the presentation was to put some light or to highlight this issue. I think we all of us look forward to what's going to happen in the next years with this particular issue of open data. I wanted to highlight that not only open data, but more generally transparency, again, is one of those very fuzzy topics that can be grasped from very different perspective. There's much to be done in terms of measuring what are the actual impacts of this. There are cross-topping issues like privacy questions that in the end are very key to define actually what kind of information may be available or not, no matter if it's going to be through an information request or through its proactive data publication. What I would like to see again is this policy to get improved, to get to see more data out there. Now, using the NGO hat, we see in this a big opportunity. There's big challenges, but also there's a big opportunity to use this data, again, either to create public services, but also to hold governments to account. And we're going to use whatever we can, if it's online public data, if it's through information requests. But again, we're looking forward to see the development of this issue in the upcoming years. So thanks a lot for all your comments and for being here today. So thank you.